Hello, I'm Helen Dalley. Welcome to Build It, They'll Come. Candid interviews with amazing Australian entrepreneurs who started with a humble idea and built it into something substantial and sustainable. It's the human face behind how they built it. On today's episode...
So you claim at this stage that your test, which isn't being done presently by anyone, can screen an embryo and a frozen egg for 2,500 severe genetic disorders or life-threatening diseases. Is that right?
Correct, except for the egg test. That is something that we are looking to develop, but we haven't developed yet.
You're about to meet a brilliant Aussie scientist transferring his scientific ingenuity into business. Dr. Nick Murphy's startup, Gen Embryomics, is frontier tech in reproductive medicine. From their base in Melbourne, Nick and his small team developed the first ever whole genome sequencing test that effectively screens for some 2,500 genetic diseases in IVF embryos, all in one simple test. In short, Nick claims to be revolutionising pre-implantation genetic testing and diagnosis in embryos to give couples the most information and the best outcomes. Gen Embryomics is in the process of securing patents in the massive US IVF market worth some $9 billion, and Nick is aiming to list his startup on the NASDAQ exchange in New York in mid-2024. Here's Nick Murphy.
Dr. Nick Murphy, the founder of the new startup Gen Embryomics. Welcome to Build It, They'll Come, first of all. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
For those of us not in the medical field or the science field, PGT, I presume, means pre-genetic testing labs?
It's a mouthful, pre-implantation genetic testing.
Okay. So right from having done your PhD, you wanted to be a genetic expert, a genetic specialist.
Oh, I wanted to just be a scientist and work in the laboratory and do interesting and fascinating work. And when it became apparent that whole genome sequencing could have a remarkable benefit to patients, that's when we started exploring the potential for it further.
Yeah. So, Nick Murphy, I mean, so you're a PhD scientist, not a medical doctor. We'll just sort of point that out and clarify that. I mean, others have trodden that path of going out on their own, leaving a bigger company to do their own thing. But why couldn't you stay in one of the more established companies, IVF clinics, to do what you ended up wanting to do?
After working in the IVF industry, I then went to work at Genetic Technologies. Genetic Technologies has a remarkable breadth of experience with developing clinical genetic tests. And that was a learning curve for me. And I cut my teeth there. And it was during my time at Genetic Technologies, I felt that I'd learned what I needed to in order to generate the rollout for clinical genetic testing using whole genome sequencing on IVF embryos.
But was there no capacity to say to that company, which had already been established, why don't we do this? Why don't we invest in this? Why don't you back me in this sort of project, but inside an existing company? I'm just interested in this process of thinking, I need to do this sort of on my own.
There is all sorts of different decisions that would need to be made across in an IVF testing company. And I'm sure that they did do their assessments, but it was very early days, the original research and the discovery work, and certainly the years before of the looking at the business potential of this. And maybe it was a bit too premature at that stage for them. So. Without speaking on their behalf, there was still a lot of legwork still to go ahead.
So tell us exactly what is Gen Embryomics. I think I've got that pronunciation right.
So Gen Embryomics is, we're starting with one flagship test, which is our IVF embryo whole genome sequencing test. And it was originally designed to be as comprehensive a genetic test for an IVF embryo, which could be feasible. The absolute boundaries of the limits would be captured, and you would know the actual health if there is an otherwise tragedy, which would have been haven't had if this had gone to a live birth, either a severely disabling or life-threatening genetic disease. This is what Gen Embryomics does. We screen for those mutations that would otherwise have resulted in that in a live birth.
Okay, so you claim at this stage that your test, which isn't being done presently by anyone, can screen an embryo and a frozen egg for, what, 2,500 severe genetic disorders or life-threatening diseases. Is that right?
Correct, except for the egg test. That is something that we are looking to develop, but we haven't developed yet.
Okay, so just explain how it works, that why haven't we got it now? I mean, why hasn't it been happening before now?
It does take a large amount of R&D in order to show that this is feasible. The validations which are required are extremely extensive, and the thorough peer review process, that does take some amount of time.
But we have had genome, you know, the genome being tracked and available for a number of years now.
Yes. There is also the practical cost side of things. It's not been until very recently that you wouldn't be looking upwards of $5,000 per single test for this sort of thing. And there has been a clear titration point where the prices have suddenly dropped, and you're looking at virtually, you know, one-fifth to one-tenth the price for just a raw sample to be sequenced. So it's been a practical issue as well, that even if there was, this test had been made, there'd be a large cost barrier, which has now been coincidentally resolved.
Okay, so you said there's been, you know, you've had to go through hoops, I guess, to get to that point. Can it be successful as a test? Is it only on embryos?
Yes and no. The primary target for the investigation is the embryo. We utilize the parents' genome sequence, though. This enables us to know if this is a mutation which is in the parents, which has been transmitted through to the embryo, or if this is a brand new, also known as a de novo mutation.
So is that, have parents not been tested before?
They wouldn't have been, no.
Well, there's been no genetic testing on parents going through the IVF process.
Unless there's an a priori reason for them to, if there's a known family genetic disease, then yes, absolutely. And there's a large number of very clear, very accurate genetic tests which can target cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs disease, which will be able to screen an embryo for that particular disease. Test, however, we screen for all of those in one single test.
And you screen for a lot more diseases as well.
Absolutely. We stick to what are considered ethically acceptable screening. So this is where there is a track record of these diseases, for these genes, for these mutations being previously screened, and that's accepted.
All right, I want to get back to the whole question of ethics later in the interview, but I still, for our listeners, I'd like to sort of, you know, enable them to get their head around this. So how does the paying public, the eventual clients of yours, know and can trust that this test has been tested properly and it isn't, and that it is foolproof? Are you at that stage yet?
This is the part of the where peer review is so important, where the publishing of our work, of our findings, of our performance, of all the different performance metrics, which goes into your analytical validation, showing this is the repeatable performance of the test each and every time. There's also the clinical validation, showing that in a clinical setting, that this test works and is repeatable, as is being indicated.
And where are all those results? Are they published?
They're either published in academic journals or in conference procedures.
So the public, when it does become available to them, and I understand it won't be available to them for a little while or for some time. Can you just take us through that? And then I was going to ask, can they be sure that it's been validated and that it's effective?
We are currently rolling out in the USA, in specific locations in Europe, and we're setting up with our IVF lab partners for that. And yes, absolutely. The publicly available release of that data for dissemination is absolutely a part of this process.
And has the test been released yet?
No, we're in the rollout stage at the moment, yes.
Yeah, okay. So you're getting your funding in place, and we'll talk about the float and that sort of thing a bit later. But does that all have to be in place before, obviously, you do the rollout to the public or to the IVF clinics?
No, not necessarily. There's all sorts of, for accepting samples from specific labs, ensuring that all of the logistics and the sample transfer chain is all in place, and all these micro details of setting things up on a per clinic basis are still required. And so that's what we're in the process of at the moment, in the parallel with doing our clinical validation study.
So you're still in the process of clinical validation as well?
Yes.
Okay. So can you just give us a few more examples of what diseases or mutations your test will cover? Will screen successfully for?
Yes, absolutely. So there's the ones I mentioned before. So couples that would be having their IVF testing, and they wouldn't otherwise know that maybe they're both carriers of cystic fibrosis. So they would be going through their IVF process and both being carriers of the Delta F508 mutation, which is relatively common, one in every, depending on what your ethnicity is, one in every 15 to one in every 30 people will be a carrier of this, but maybe unbeknownst to them, they are a carrier. And we'll be, just as part and parcel of our test, screening for that. And if this embryo is known to be affected, then this will be reported back.
But we can do that now, can't we? We can test for cystic fibrosis now.
Yes. But is it? That's the question.
What do you mean, is it?
But it's not actually tested at the moment. It could be, yes, but there is no genetic test which people do beforehand. If they have carrier screening, then yes, they would have been tested, most likely, depending on which company you actually go for, it would have been on that carrier screening panel. However, this is for transmitted mutations or inherited mutations. A brand new mutation, even one specific nucleotide in the CFTR gene, having carrier screening can never pick up a brand new mutation. It hasn't occurred yet because fertilization hasn't occurred yet. Only after that embryo is created,
right,
will that mutation be able to be detected. And it may only need to come from one parent, a transmitted one, and a brand new mutation on the other strand. That would result in the active disease. And that's what our test picks up for too.
That's what your test picks up. So can you give me some other examples besides cystic fibrosis?
So that would be an autosomal, that's a recessive disease. Well, you need the two copies of, there's also dominant diseases. So a specific mutation in an autosomal dominant gene would actually also generate one of these phenotypes. And it's funny how the actual rate of these autosomal dominant de novo mutations, the live birth incidence of these is as high as 1 in 25 live births. being of having an active, severe genetic disease.
Yes, sorry to bring you back to layman's terms, but I wonder, can you explain to people some of the diseases that your test will be able to screen for and therefore maybe reduce the incidence of live births with those diseases?
Down syndrome is that's a chromosome disease. Mm-hmm. So that's having a third copy, three copies, pardon me, of chromosome 21. And that's so that is what is as standard is currently tested as a part of pre-implantation genetic testing at the moment, having that a third copy of chromosome 21. And that's a standard part of current testing.
Right, so that's not new, but will it be included in your test?
Yes, it will. Yes,
yeah,
it is.
Okay.
The test, it's called Panacea Genome Screen. And it tests for nucleotide resolution base changes, as well as larger events. And these are typically quite challenging to define. These are called copy number variants and can be anywhere from 50 to 100 nucleotides all the way up to 10,000 nucleotides. Mm. And these can also be causative. You're going to walking me through all my different background of genetics. There's expansion disease. Now there's you're looking at diseases like Fragile X. So that's where on the X chromosome there's an increased number of these three nucleotides in a row. And when you go over a certain threshold and it becomes quite high, that's when you get Fragile X disease. And that's what our Panacea genome screen also picks up. There's mosaicisms, which is also very prominent, and that's where half of the embryo is carrying the mutation, a de novo mutation, and the other half is not. There's structural variants, which is where the chromosomes start switching over and binding to each other where they shouldn't do. There's a whole manner of different combinations of these, whether they're transmitted or de novo, which can occur. And this is what the test screens for.
Would something like, and pardon my ignorance about genetics, but would something like Huntington's disease or some of those diseases be able to be tested for by your test?
Yes. It's Huntington's disease is outside of the typical pre-implantation genetic testing regimen. It's one of the ones where there's usually until now. Now, please mind that I'm not a clinical geneticist, but where there is a family history of Huntington disease,
yes,
that families can certainly seek out pre-implantation genetics to ensure that they're not having a child carrying the mutation.
Was there one, let's go back to sort of the business side and developing this test, was there one single catalyst for you to, for your idea to develop, you know, your own test? Was there one single factor that sort of really pushed you to do that?
I had been working in academia largely on the immune system. We'd been working on single chromosomes. They are typically, you need to amplify them. It's the same amplification reaction that you use on IVF embryos. And we were successful in able to produce a test which could find a perfect match for an unrelated bone marrow transplant from a single chromosome. It was really at that point where when we realized...
I don't understand. What's the significance of that?
Well, when you can elucidate something as complex, the most complex region of the genome is the most gene-dense and variable region of the whole genome from a single chromosome, it made it certainly practically feasible as a theory in concept that it was worth investigating to be able to do whole genome sequencing on an embryo biopsy, where you start with not just one chromosome, but maybe 5, 6, or 7 cells which have been biopsied safely from the embryo, for further analysis. That was probably where the first questions began being asked.
Did you feel you needed to do any market research, or did you know already that really this is going to work in terms of the market and the commercialization of it?
We did certainly do market research in amongst, the general public, as well as IVF experts, in how they felt how receptive they would be to such a test. And it was, I wouldn't go as far as saying universally positive, as people certainly have questions and queries, clarifications about more details about the test, but absolutely that they were open to learning more, certainly. You know, the vast majority of IVF genetic testing is just really counting the number of chromosomes. And even the name, pre-implantation genetic testing, if you're just counting the number of chromosomes, you're not really doing any genetics. There's no DNA sequence actually involved. The name is a misnomer in and of itself.
And that's what we had been doing.
Yes,
that's what we have been doing up to now.
The vast majority, yes. It's just counting the right number of chromosomes and ensuring that an ongoing pregnancy would be the result for these IVF patients struggling to get pregnant. It was my feeling that, well, if these patients are already going through this rigmarole to have this baby at the end, why not make the best testing options available to them? Well, certainly, learning the lessons of the work that everybody else has done, that's the best place to start, and what works, what doesn't work, and certainly keeping an eye on what patients are already going through. I mean, that they're already paying a significant amount for their IVF, and that if they were being asked to add a whole new level of complexity or difficulty to an already extremely difficult journey, that would be asking too much of them. So even just to start, you've got to really start from there. You can't expect these patients are already going through enough. There were lessons learned from what works in the science and the introduction of next generation sequencing made all of this possible, you know, all the way back to the human genome and the constant reducing of the price of what it would actually cost to do this test, because our test, it does require the parents to be whole genome sequenced and each and every embryo thereafter. However, there are very, very clear advantages to doing this whole genome sequencing test, aside from even the ability to screen for over 2,500 genetic diseases.
So sorry, can I just stop you there? To test the whole genome of both parents, is that invasive with the parents, or is it just incredibly time consuming and labor intensive by high level scientists?
Quite the opposite. They provide a saliva swab sample,
right?
And that's really
easy peasy.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's not complicated or tricky or painful by any means.
I was just going to say, why has the price come down so dramatically if it's not that difficult to sequence the genome of both parents?
It's the price does keep going down. There's I think it's Moore's law with the 50% reduction in the cost of this. I think the whole genome sequencing cost is mirrored that of the shrinking size of microprocessors. And there's been a very similar relationship of the cost from there, that the patents are now open and there's been several new companies mushrooming up and making their whole new sequencers now that it's not covered by the current big players in the field. So there's the market has opened up
to
lower cost whole genome sequencing.
Okay, I was going to ask you about, the hurdles that you've no doubt been through. Can you give us an idea of some of those, particularly, you know, getting patents? How difficult was that? Getting control of the IP, protecting the IP.
It really was a part of the publishing process. And this was done simultaneously with when it was, we had quite a long peer review, and we felt that this was an excellent test. And we didn't feel that if there was a cut rate or another company that would come along saying that they could do this and that they would cut corners and they wouldn't do it correctly, they wouldn't do it, they'd be looking to maximize their revenue and not actually do the test properly, that this would be the best way of ensuring that this accurate test was actually being delivered to patients by delivering this and by thereby making it available. That was really where the patent process has been coming from.
But how difficult was it to secure the patents and to protect the IP?
We're still securing some of the final stages in. We've gone for a range of jurisdictions across the world. Off the top of my head, I think we're granted, I think possibly in Australia, and we're at several of the final stages across some of them, or international jurisdictions.
So like the United States?
Yes.
So you do have patents secured, or you're still in the process?
Still in the process.
So, sorry to push you on this, but is there any danger that, you know, some of the big companies could come in and say, nah, we're going to get this and we're going to steal the patents or secure them more quickly than you can?
I think it would. We've already got our priority date lodged for it. So we're already in the pipeline for that. And we've certainly got what we feel is the best understanding of how to generate this test, and that they would have a lot of R&D in front of them before being able to get to that stage.
Was it a hurdle to get over to convince whatever regulators you had to convince that your test is efficacious and safe and et cetera?
There is a very thorough review of the performance analytics, and that our requirements for offering the test, surprisingly, for example, in the USA, our test is not actually covered by FDA approval.
Meaning you don't have to get FDA approval to sell it. Really?
Really.
So who governs whether you're, you know, selling a dud product or a very effective product?
Good question. But we still need to offer our test through CMS and as a CLIA laboratory, and we're working with partners which are approved for that. And our documentation, the details of how this test actually runs, they're all produced inside what's known as an LDT, a laboratory developed test. Now, saying though that we're not obliged to get FDA approval, and this is not our opinion on this. This is by their own definition and the history of pre-implantation genetic testing is not covered by the FDA. It is the FDA's own definitions that embryos are not classified as humans. Whether it should be this way, I have my own thoughts on the subject. I think that there certainly could be room for it, and we may still pursue FDA approval. However, we're not obliged to.
Okay, and in Australia? What regulatory body do you come under?
That would be there'd be several. There would be NATA, there would be TGA, right. But we aren't available in Australia just yet.
No, okay. And when do you think you will be available in both the United States and Australia?
United States is, I believe we're aiming for, it will be early June.
Wow.
We've started accepting our feasibility cases and for Australia, that's a TBD.
Okay. How difficult or how much of a high hurdle was it to convince investors?
I've spoken to a lot of investors, and they have very, very similar questions to yourself. You know, that's they want to know about the FDA approval process, and were similarly quite surprised that there was no FDA approval process, which we were obliged or compelled to seek to have that approval. It was almost disbelief. But investors are certainly conscious of we're under no illusions that this is there's a level of detail which you sort of have to do to digest, you know, a little bit of mental gymnastics of what is this really doing? How is this relevant? Why is this here? Why are people not doing this already? Mm-hmm. And we're conscious of that, of course. And so we aim to, when we do speak to investors, to be able to concentrate down our points to being able to communicate that with them.
Yeah. So how difficult was it to get funding? And who did you get funding from? I believe you've gone the venture capital route.
Myself being more of a scientist than having any experience or track record in business, I was helped out by some wonderful close friends who were much more savvy on this than myself. And after working on our pitch and our pitch deck, you know, in around the time, a difficult time for us all, the early stages of COVID, we were encouraged by the wonderful Michelle Clenahans to apply for the MedTech Actuator.
And Michelle Clenahans, where's she from, and what's that thing you mentioned?
She was working with the MedTech Actuator, and she was familiar with us through several discussions. And
what's the MedTech Actuator? Is it in Australia or the United States?
Yes, it's an Australian accelerator.
It's a startup hub for medical MedTech.
Yes, absolutely. And they were just wonderful. They provide a remarkable crash course in what a startup will face, all of the different things that they would be looking at, which was fun when you're actually having COVID at the same time and going through this course. And as well, we received funding from Artesium Investments. They're an Australian VC, and they've just been wonderfully supportive of our journey. And I can't not mention our close associate there, Rohan Gray, who's just been an absolute angel. No pun intended. When we were first accepted into the MedTech Actuator, we were provided with $50,000 as a startup, as at signing.
Great.
And so, yeah, that was our first real boost to get things moving along, as well as the beginning of formalizing and professionalizing Genembryomics as a business.
Mm-hmm.
It was some time after that, really, the next step change was getting the interest of a key opinion leader in the field, Professor Santiago Munay.
Mm.
And he's one of the most successful IVF and IVF genetics personalities that you could find, you know, hundreds of peer-reviewed academic papers, and really led the field of pre-implantation genetics. And we met him. And
American? He's based in America?
He's from Spain, and but is, yes, in America. And so he joined the company and invested with his VC, Homu Health Ventures.
Right.
And
sorry, Nick, when was that? You started in, what, 2019. When did you get the actuator money, and then when did Homu Fund come in?
So it would have been, you're taking me back several years now, is probably 2000, entered in the MedTech Actuator 2021, and it was the year following that or at the end of 21 that Homo Health Ventures started taking interest in us, and Santi, as we call him, joined the company and our board.
And is he still with you?
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. How many employees do you have now?
Oh, we've got a couple of dozen.
Right, yeah. So they're very specialised and you don't need that many employees. So you are a specialty player, but are you trying to achieve some scale in a business sense?
Absolutely. This was the reason why I started on this journey, was to make this test available to people. And that's really the outcome which I'm looking for, is to have this absolutely available. So we work with sequencing facilities all over the world, and that's enabling us to roll out this rollout so much faster, have this test available to people, and allow clinicians to have this tool put into their hands.
Yeah. So just explain to me a little bit about the business model. Will you offer your genetic test direct to IVF couples through your own clinics, or will you offer it to other clinicians who already have existing IVF clinics and they deal with the end customer?
Yeah, they certainly deal with so really our customers are the IVF clinics. We handle obviously the patient data and issue them their reports, but it is their clinician that is still providing them with that report and able to, you know, speak about the findings on any given report intelligently, the context behind these results, the genetic counseling which may be required for them. No, that's certainly on the IVF clinics side. So no, we're not a direct to patients or consumers test at this stage. No, we work with the IVF clinics.
Yeah. Nick, can you just in one sentence describe, encapsulate what your test does? I know we talked about it at the beginning, but if you in one sentence could tell me exactly what it does in layman's terms.
We screen the DNA of these IVF embryos to provide the opportunity for a healthy child.
By screening what?
The DNA. It's we can encapsulate it down in that. We screen the entirety of their DNA.
For what? What are you screening for?
Genetic disease. I'm guilty of considering that our short list, these 2,500 genetic diseases, by default, virtually are the most severe, significant, profoundly affecting, disabling, or fatal genetic diseases.
You're now on the path, as I understand it, to listing not on the Australian Stock Exchange, but on the NASDAQ exchange in the United States. Why that path?
The NASDAQ is a remarkable, just the magnitude and the volumes of the trades that go there. We're under no illusions that we're raising a significant amount of funds, and this will enable the largest rollout of our test as soon as possible.
How big is the market, the potential market in the United States for IVF testing?
Well, yeah, it's funny, when I first started speaking about the rate of couples seeking IVF, when I first started this journey, I was saying it was 1 in 7 or 1 in 6, and it's now 1 in 5 couples are now seeking assisted fertility.
Will they all want your test?
Every second embryo in the US has a modicum of genetic testing being performed on it. So
already,
the actual raw numbers of the numbers of embryos which are screened, say, on a monthly basis. That's currently not available, which is quite frustrating. We've had to extrapolate from data sources and make assumptions, but we have a good idea. But really, it would be well over a million embryos in the US alone are being screened annually. And the EU, I mean, it's even twice as large as the USA's. So there's a very, very large number of these tests potentially, which whole genome sequencing could and really should be the test.
Yeah. So can you put a dollar figure on the size of, say, the US market alone in IVF? I've seen it published in the AFR. They put on $9 billion US dollars.
So the IVF, let's get specific here. The IVF market, what the market size is for our genetic test specifically, where we are in a funny space. We're able to be sort of that halfway point between the size of the IVF testing market in the US and what you could also define as being the whole genome sequencing market. So we're in that Venn diagram, that middle place, sort of residing in the center, but it would be certainly into the billions.
Wow. Can we just talk ethics a little bit, if I may? Do you see any ethical issues that arise from your test? I mean, obviously, this is your life's work, and so whatever ethical issues may have come up, you've dealt with them and managed them.
We haven't been really confronted with many ethical problems to date, but we're also looking to constantly improve our test. And if that means removing a gene from our list of over 2,500 because of the evidence, so be it. Absolutely. If another gene should be added to it, absolutely, so be it. So we're not just looking to place this flag in the ground and say this is how it is and how it's going to forever be. And it's also going to, I mean, these things are going to depend on the ethnicity of the couple as well. That these will change depending on what the ethnic background of the couple is.
Can your test screen for gender or sex?
In Australia, we are we're not allowed legally to do a gender selection. And it really depends on different countries of what their legislations allow or don't allow. And yes, we do need to be conscious of that, depending on where we're issuing reports. But we have to respect the rules, the laws of the
country. Okay, in Australia you can't. What about the United States?
You can.
You can screen for gender. And then
You
can gender select. So that means you could do away with an embryo that, or not select an embryo that is a particular sex that the couple doesn't want.
Yes. That's what is being done at the moment.
That's being done. Will your test do that? And will you do it once it's on the market?
We do report gender as is standard for all of the PGT providers, yes.
So does that mean at the moment in the United States, pardon my ignorance again, that people can select out if they don't want a girl or if they don't want a boy in their embryos?
I believe so, yes.
Do you see any issue with that?
We have an issue with that it makes it difficult in a practical sense, but as long as we're staying on the right side of the law, we have to follow the laws of the country. So whether or not it should be being done in an ethical perspective, we live in Australia, and me and my family have never done that.
But it is an interesting question because you're heading down the path to list on the NASDAQ with a view to wanting to be big in the United States. So your test will be no doubt used for this purpose, or could be.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And you're comfortable with that?
If I wasn't, then either making it available or not available through not reporting on that test wouldn't be the way that I'd be going about addressing it. Yeah.
Sorry, how would you address it? What do you mean?
Well, if there's reasons why a couple are looking to do gender selection, I think it would be better at looking at that than to whether or not the genetic test should be putting it on the genetic report.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave that issue aside for the moment. It's so interesting. And of course, it's been talked about, I guess, a lot over several decades.
It is.
But go on.
Well, we're under no illusions that we're bringing available real frontier tech. We have been invited to the ASRM, the new tech. New techs which are being rolled out. So the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, and we want to begin discussing these things and the multiplicity of other issues which are suddenly presented by doing this. The everything from the standards, which if other companies are going to try doing this, which really need to be met on a per sample basis, the ethical considerations, the genes, all of these things need to be brought to the professional community and discussed. And we are extremely in favor of that. Absolutely.
Yeah. I guess the other issue that comes up with any genetic testing, I mean, to the normal layperson, it sounds completely awesome that you may be able to screen out and thereby reduce or eliminate really severe genetic diseases or life-threatening diseases. But are there some who might find it offensive who do have a child already that didn't have the benefit of such test to say, well, you want to do away with children like mine, and we love our child in our family, even though they may have a severe disorder? Is that a strange way of looking at it, or could that come up that people find it offensive what you're wanting to eliminate?
It can certainly be a part of the discourse. Absolutely. No, it's certainly a relevant point of view. I have four wonderful children, and including one special needs child. And each child is different and
adds something to the family, I presume.
Absolutely. Certainly, we love all of our kids completely, but the list of what genes, this is not come from us. This is from what is already being done. This is what's already in place.
Sorry, what do you mean?
The diseases which we use, these are the tests which are already being performed. Mm-hmm. This is not us going out and saying, well, the TAB2 gene, which will cause, you know, that this has to be the way, that this is, and this is only Genembryomics opinion. Now, we're doing what the community has already agreed to do and are currently doing. So this is,
but you are taking it further. You said you were on the frontier.
Yes,
and you are screening for a lot more diseases.
Yes, yeah. All in one single test. Yes.
Right. Just, I wanted to ask you, and it may not be strictly speaking your area, so please set me straight if it's not, but I'm interested in your view of, it seems, and it may only be anecdotal, an increasing number of younger women are freezing their eggs, but I understand that the risk of unfreezing them, the risks of unfreezing them, it's not always successful.
Yes, no, this isn't a, my background is genetics more than embryology, but and it does go back to the question that that you had before, is was our test available for eggs? We're certainly looking in that direction because we have been asked as to these women who are freezing. The name that is used is social egg freezing, that they are being frozen, and could our test work on that to actually see, are these actually suitable for freezing? Well, yes, we are working on that as a genetic test because people need to know.
Yeah. Do you know whether when it comes time to unfreeze a frozen egg, the unfreezing process is not so successful in terms of, I guess, the efficaciousness of the egg?
I'm actually not. I haven't heard anything detrimental. I do know that the procedures that they use are extremely thorough. And, that there has been a lot of R&D for decades going into refining this to a very fine art. My side is more of from the screening the egg to see if it will actually be suitable for that decade later for use. So that is what we are working on at the moment.
Yeah. Nick, I've just got a few more questions to ask you in our remaining time. I mean, your childhood was in Melbourne. Were you always a kind of a scientific kid, or were you always interested? Was it genetics you were interested in, or working in a lab? Were your folks in science, or were they in business?
No, I was born in Tasmania. I'm a Hobart boy. And when I was very young, my father took a job in Hong Kong. And so for most of my youth, a good 12 years over there, I was raised over in the international melting pot of the schools over there, which was just a wonderful place to experience and grow up in. Very, very lucky to have been raised in that. And no, my father is in education development, distance education, as a Monash professor of before he retired in education development, and certainly.
And your mum?
My mum, she was just our mum who had to take care of her two overly rambunctious children that were a lot of trouble.
Right. But education, I imagine, was a very high priority in your household, and to probably excel and
not
to
at all,
learn.
Actually.
No?
You'd be surprised. No, there's always with kids, you know, certain standards that you certainly have to hit. But no, there was never overly any pressure to more of just let the kids all, they'll be interested in what they're interested in, regardless if we push them into this, that, the other. And there was no grand pressure to in that regard, or either that or I've blocked it out.
Did you always want to be a scientist as a young person or in your later years at school?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I did a couple of years of engineering at Monash University.
Right, yes, okay.
And so, science. Yeah.
And then how did you come into genetics?
I think it's just grabbing onto what interests. And I'm a big believer in that with our kids, is to you let them find what interests them, what they're passionate about, what they enjoy doing. And it's sort of just caught my curiosity more than anything.
Yeah, Dr. Nick Murphy, a lot of medical tech companies have failed. A number have been, you know, stupendously successful, but a number do fail. What's your secret sauce, do you think, that makes you feel like we're not going to fail? This is going to work in a business sense?
That's a very good question. Maybe I don't have one.
Would you say it's
our job well?
Yeah.
And we're doing that as we're making our products available to people. We make the best genetic tests, which are feasible to generate. We do it the right way. If we can do those things, then we maximize our chances.
How do you handle risk? Because, you know, you're trained as a scientist, but you're now in business and, you know, managing risk, but not being risk averse is very important. Managing cash flow, managing the few employees you do have.
Risk is a funny thing, isn't it?
Sure is.
I learned a lot about risk at Genetic Technologies, actually. I thought that I had gotten my head around a lot of risk, and then I started working there, and their business is genetic risk. So I learned a lot from the genetic tests which were developed before I started there, because they developed, this is really led the field, was Richard Allman, who made the first non-BRCA, non-pathogenic mutation genetic risk test for breast cancer and making it clinically available. And this is actually, when you're at high risk, this is actually making it more likely than even the BRCA mutation carriers themselves. So there was a lot of learning about the determination of risk, the calculation of risk, how that carries over to the business side of genembryomics. I'm not quite sure. Maybe each and every day is different, and you've got to look at all of the risks as best you can.
Yeah.
And work from there.
Yeah. Do you feel you draw on the experience of your VC investors? Do they, you know, are you on the phone to them once a week, once a day, once a month?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. No, they're always available and have just been wonderful partners all the way through this journey. And I even commented to them the other day of how long we've been in this journey together. And they've been remarkable, RTC, and they really have.
One other issue, I guess, is how expensive your tests will be. You've been saying that the general price has been coming down, but do you have a sort of a set amount that you think it will be for, say, a couple who are the end users of your product?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, the costings, where and it's going to be different in different places around the world, because the costs are different in different places around the world. It's looking like in Europe it will be slightly more expensive than say the USA.
Okay. Are we talking 10, 15 grand, or are we talking 2, 3, 4 grand?
Once the parents have had their genome sequenced, and that's sub $1,000 each, we're looking to be there about that $1,500 mark, and keep driving that price down. The lower the price that we're offered from sequencing providers, the lower the price of the test that we can make this available. We want to make this test available to people. We don't want this being price capped. However, I mean, even our test is available to a larger number of embryos anyway. We can do our test on just standard IVF embryos. Typically, in this process, if you need genetic testing, it's what's called as ICSI. It's where a sperm is actually injected into an egg. And that's an expensive procedure. It's another thing to do, and it has to be done right, professionally and perfectly. And our test doesn't need that.
Wow. So you're saying most or all of the genetic testing now does need that, but your test won't. So that takes another layer of cost out.
Absolutely. And our test is able to, we've got remarkable advantages. We're able to detect fertility fraud. And there's been a few high profile cases of this where these doctors have used their own semen.
Oh,
and our test
what?
Picks that up.
No.
Yes, there's been I think in the US a couple of cases of this, and our test picks this up.
Wow. So why would they do that? Do they know that the sperm of the father donor isn't strong enough?
I don't know why they would do that. I think it's
bizarre.
Yeah.
It's completely appalling. Your test picks that up because you've done the testing on the two parents,
yes,
on the genome. Wow. So briefly, what are the other advantages of your test? Picks up fertility fraud.
that we can use for all types of embryo tests.
Right.
That the ICSI and the standard IVF embryos. There's also an advantage to it is going to probably be another year or two away, but we're certainly looking to utilize the parents' genome to help them elucidate why they're on this IVF infertility journey. The terrible phrase that still 30% of IVF patients walk away with at the end of the day of unexplained infertility, I don't find particularly acceptable. I think that there is things that could be discovered inside the genome. There's all sorts of pharmacogenetics, the stimulation regimen that the women need to go through to have this IVF, that there's all sorts of responders. There's non-responders. And then there's hyper-responders. And being a hyper-responder can be fatal. All of this stuff from the parents' genomes we can elucidate, which is why another use case for why it's so relevant, this test now.
It's just fantastic. A couple of really quick questions that I'm asking all my guests. What's the toughest thing you've learned on your business journey or that you've faced? The toughest thing you've faced on your business journey?
Well, that's a good one.
Was it going for funding? Is it managing people now that you do have employees dependent on you, dependent on the test?
Yeah, and absolutely, and it's really finding out more about that type of relationship. It's certainly that we're dependent on them. That yes, they're dependent on us, and we're dependent on them. It's a relationship, absolutely. Certainly, the fundraising road. It's been a long time of many years to get to here, and I know what it is. It's the lack of holidays. I haven't had a holiday in a very, very long time.
Really? Well, I mean, this is important.
Yes.
Can you take one?
I hope so. Sometime soon, I hope. Maybe after the NASDAQ listing.
Maybe after the listing.
Less than a decade after, hopefully.
Hopefully much sooner than that. And when do you expect the NASDAQ listing?
We're planning for a submission very, very shortly, and so it's looking like May, May-ish, potentially June.
Maybe later in the year.
Oh, no, sooner rather than
okay.
later.
Okay. Yeah. And what sort of, I know the figures wouldn't be definite yet, but what sort of valuation, market capitalization would you be aiming for, targeting?
We've received an estimate. It's quite a broad one of between 25 to 40 mil.
Great. What's the biggest lesson you've learned on this business journey?
Biggest lesson I've learned. The problem here is the word biggest. There's so many. Which one is the is the ultimate one? That's the one that's I'm tripping up over.
Well, you weren't a business person. You said that, and you know you've come from a science, and you still are in the science world. So, is it actually the nuts and bolts of having to do a business? Is it getting your head around, you know, tax and PA, whatever taxes you have to pay? Is it learning to deal with the relationships of employees and managers?
No, I think you had it right there, that it's that vast, the complexities of running a business can be, for a noob, they can be rather nebulous. So a lot of catch up to do from, genomics, and genetics, sometimes can seem remarkably straightforward compared to, running a business.
And what do you say to other would-be entrepreneurs who want to back their own idea?
I'd like to hear the idea, and then speak specifically to them about it. Yeah.
Would you say do it? Would you say go for it? Or would you say be very specific about what you're after? Don't just do it for the money.
I'd want to offer them comment after hearing what the idea is. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe if they need guidance on whether this is such a good idea after all, or maybe it's an absolute fantastic idea, and just keep going.
Dr. Nick Murphy, the founder and someone who's really been pushing this wonderful idea of Gen Embryomics. Thank you so much for joining us on Build It, They'll Come.
Thank you so much for having me, Helen. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed Build It, They'll Come. Let me know via Twitter and LinkedIn. Better still, let your family, friends and colleagues know by sharing it around your networks. And I'd love you to give it a star rating on Apple Podcasts to make it easier for others to find us. Be sure to subscribe, as there are plenty of upcoming episodes you don't want to miss, with more amazing innovators and entrepreneurs on how they turn their light bulb idea into an empire.